I'm now going to say something that will astonish you.
Ich bin ein Violiner.
Wir wissen, dass nur die Panzer.
I have a dream.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We are living in an increasingly polarized world.
My administration has accomplished more than almost any administration.
We must begin now.
Welcome to the Bulletin Podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new season of the Bulletin Podcast. This is your producer, Hussein Al-Malla, and here's what's coming up in our first episode.
Privacy in the Age of Digitalization with Dr. Husnain Bukhari.
The information collection and its reuse depends on and varies from platform to platform. The situation can get actually very critical.
And of course, updates from the Brand School.
Hello, hello. This is Caroline von Stein, one of the producers of the Bulletin Podcast and a first-year MPP student at the Witte Brand School.
And this is Jesus Renzullo, also producer of the Bulletin Podcast and first-year MPP student.
So here we are, the first episode of the newly revived Bulletin Podcast. Jesus, would you like to tell us what this podcast is all about?
Yeah, of course. So the goal of the podcast is to discuss timely topics through the lens of our viewers, the Witte Brand School community, with professors and students from all over the world studying a range of public policy issues. We wanted to provide different perspectives on four different issues this year, starting with privacy. Each month, we'll provide a hot take from an expert of the Witte Brand School community on one of these topics.
Cool, yes. So the podcast will be released on the last Thursday of every month, so keep an eye out for it then. This inaugural episode is the first of a two-part series on privacy in the digital era. Jesus, last week you talked to Dr. Husnain Bukhari about privacy, social media, and GDPR. Who is Dr. Bukhari and why did we want to talk to him?
It was a great talk. Dr. Husnain Bukhari has been teaching at the Brand School since 2006. He has worked as an assistant professor at the University of Erfurt, designing projects focusing on politics in internet and peace education. Not only that, but he's also an associate of the Center of Development of Informatics at the University of Manchester. His research interests include e-government, ICT for development, cybersecurity, and digital entrepreneurship. So I think he was the guy to talk with when talking about privacy and social media. We wanted to talk about things like GDPR, the problem of geotagging, and the problem of how much privacy do we really have in internet.
Exactly. He has a lot to say, so let's check it out.
Thank you again so much for being here with us, Dr. Bukhari. The topic of data companies and social media is really trendy right now. In March, the CEOs of Facebook, Google, and Twitter are going to declare before the US Congress regarding misinformation in their platforms. We all get worried every time these big techs like Google or Facebook face a scandal for data sharing or data leakage. How much do these information intermediaries know about us, and how dangerous is it for our privacy?
Well, thank you very much for your invitation. I'm very pleased to be here in this podcast on privacy and social media and internet. It's a pleasure to be interacting with the Brand School again. To your question, what do they know about us? I think it would be fair to say, what do they not know about us? You know, the information collection and its reuse depends on and varies from platform to platform. If we take Google, for instance, one of their leading products is, of course, the search engine. Google is without a doubt the most popular search engine with, I guess, 65 to 70% market share. However, it is not just the search engine which is their sole product. It offers different services such as email, blogging platform. YouTube is now also owned by them, and it has also started a payment mechanism. And then it also offers a cloud platform, the Google Drive. So all these applications collect information such as name, email, phone number, payment information. That is all collected. But apart from what it also collects is also the thing which we call as unique identifiers, such as our IP address. You know, sometimes our system crashes and it generates a report. This system crash reports is also, collected. The system activity, the date and time and referrals of our URL requests, and also the interaction between different apps, browser type and device type, application versions and application usage. And if you're talking about GSM interactions, then you can also consider carrier name. So based on all this, I would actually divide information collected in different categories. So it's not just personal information. Actually, I would rather see it in one as personal information. Then you have financial information, and then you can also have device information. And then you can also add application and software-based information. But on the other hand, you just mentioned Facebook. So if you look at Facebook, it is purely out and out your social profile on the web. The business models relish on knowing as much information as possible. So, and I do not here mean the personal data just, you know, it's also our behavioral data. So in personal category, it's just the people we interact with, the groups we are part of, our comments, and our various forms of information that we share. So imagine Facebook's revenue is what, about $85 billion, I guess. And its shares are traded in stock market, and it runs basically on the basis of personal information that you and I share. So there is one obvious information that we share, but then there's also algorithms that run behind social media platforms that are smart. I mean, the algorithms are smart enough so we can get profiled on the basis of our online behavior. So people or groups that we look for, or information that we search for, or the smart algorithms have the ability to track all these information on the basis of what we get, also the targeted advertisements. And that's where social media platforms receive their revenue. So now you ask me, how dangerous is this for our privacy? I think, first of all, it's important to identify the avenues or areas of our privacy, which I just tried to divide into different categories, such as personal, financial, device-based, and behavioral. And even within behavioral category, there are also subcategories, our social behavior, our shopping behavior, and there can be more. So you see, it's not just these platforms, online platforms, that force us to become their subscribers. At least this is how it is so far. But it is us who choose to be a part of these platforms. And we expect that our information is safe and we'll be protected. But how many of us actually read the terms and conditions that we just say, I agree? You know, we just press the button, I agree. You know, when I was teaching this section on cybersecurity and privacy in my last seminar at the Brand School, I conducted a very basic survey of my participants. And it tells me, and most importantly for the participants of my course, it tells me how much they know about privacy. And I just asked very basic questions, you know, like, for example, how many times a year do you review your security and privacy section of your social media profile? Is your browser set on auto-delete cookies when it exists? Or what happens when you are shopping online? Do you see or do you look for a lock symbol in the address bar? Or do you use the same password for other websites? So there are about 10 questions that I ask, you know, which tells me and shows the results right away on the screen to participants as well. And frankly speaking, I have so far not come across a statistic that was above 60%.
Well, I think the word that we all look for here is overwhelming. So much data being put into the cloud, into these big files. And this goes even beyond, because it's not only our shopping or behavioral data, it's also our location, with the problem of geotagging that raised, you know, a lot of concerns. We would like to ask, or we would like to know, how does geotagging works, and for what reason is this metadata collected? And furthermore, what problems could cause if a company or another party has access to this information?
Geotagging is basically the process of identifying a physical location. So whether it's a photo or a video, or you're just posting something online, like even a status. So your physical location is tagged with it. So this option is mostly available in social media platforms such as Instagram or Snapchat, Twitter or Facebook. Now, what location identification here means that the information of your exact geographic coordinates get embedded to the images, the videos, or any other media that is recorded by our GPS-enabled smartphones or GPS-enabled smart devices. So basically, it's the geospatial metadata, which contains the latitude, longitude, altitude, almost everything about your physical location.
They know where you are.
And because of this physical location, on one hand, we let our followers know where we are and when was the photo taken or created. On the other hand, it's important to know why geotagging matters to digital platforms. You see, tech platforms such as social media platforms run on advertisements and data. Our personal data is like oxygen for them. So it's because of our data, they are able to attract advertisements. And when it comes to geotagging, there's a special sector in marketing terminology, which is called as location-based marketing. So based on our geotagged data, we can be the potential recipients of future advertisements and products that are around and near our location.
Whole strategy.
So you can also think from business perspective, for example. Let's say you represent a business based here in Erfurt and you have an app and you can use your customers' physical location to present them various product offers. So if the businesses are able to record your IP and also maybe Wi-Fi information, then you could offer products based on their multiple devices under whatever customers they are using. The problem here is, if we were wishing to be anonymous and geotagging was enabled, then the problem is that the physical location was just on. I feel that this is particularly dangerous for web activists or bloggers, whose posts are sometimes critical of social structures and governing structures and systems.
Yeah.
So in such a case, their life is in pretty much a threat if geotagging is on. The same would also apply, I would imagine, to whistleblowers. If their identity can't be protected, then the idea of anonymity is just that,
Of course.
There have been cases in the past where people were away in vacations and they were geotagging their photos and status updates while the burglars and stalkers were actually breaking into their house and stealing stuff.
Yeah.
But Jesus, my fear is a little different here when you brought the topic of geotagging.
Mm-hmm.
If you put geotagging in international security perspective, the situation can get actually very critical. Imagine you work for a security firm or you represent a government institution which hosts a very critical and sensitive installation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, no government would like information or precise physical location of this physical information of this location to go public. But what if one of their employees happened to use social media platform and happened to use geotags? We are talking about exposure of national asset, and charges could be even treason.
It's a whole threat.
How would you prove that your act of geotagging was just an innocent act of not knowing what it can lead to? So you see, Jesus, my fears are a bit different here. You remember I earlier mentioned you this survey that I conduct in my class, that how many participants check their privacy or security status of their social media applications. The thing is that the apps or even physical devices like mobile phones or tablets, by default, they keep the GPS and geotagging enabled. So actually, it becomes our responsibility to continuously check and see the status of privacy. At least that's the least we can do, you know?
Of course. I think it's a big responsibility and a lot to take in. But I mean, all these problems, all these data, all these leakages, they just don't pass over the governments. They have to respond.
Absolutely.
And one of the things, a good example of this response is the General Data Protection Regulation of the EU that was created exactly to protect our data. So how far does this regulation go? How much does it protect us, really? And are there any loopholes that we should be worried about and that we should start solving? Because at the end of the day, this is all our information. This is all our life.
The GDPR, you mean, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been now, 5 years that the GDPR is in, or 4 years that the GDPR is now in place? Historically speaking, you know, when we look back at the decade of 2010 and 20, I think it might be categorized as, you know, allow me to say, a disaster when it comes to data breach and data privacy. We thought that cloud platforms were safe, or at least this is what we were told. But in 2016, Dropbox announced that more than 60 million Dropbox user accounts were compromised. More than 60 million. I know that a lot of mobile phones offer photo galleries connectivity to Dropbox, and you know, where can it lead to such kind of a breach? Then, on the other hand, we use LinkedIn for our business networking, and it does not contain just friends or family, you know, but actually most of our professional contacts are there on LinkedIn. Well, guess what? In 2012, LinkedIn announced that about 160 or 170 million user accounts were compromised. And so goes for Yahoo. I mean, they suffered two major breaches back in 2013 and 2014. Facebook also reportedly said that in 2018, there was an attack on their computer, and because of that, 50 million users were exposed. And I think you already know about their infamous Cambridge Analytica scandal.
Yes, of course.
So, you know, when I say that 2010 to 2020 could be considered as a disaster, then it might be, you might know that what I'm talking about. And considering all these breaches, I feel that it's important that EU introduced a stricter version of data protection regulation. You can consider GDPR as a legal framework that has set guidelines for the collection and processing of personal information from individuals who actually are based only in European Union. I feel it was important to let people know that how companies are using or also reusing the personal data. So what GDPR did to put an individual like you and me at the center of rights. So there are about 8 rights that they have defined, that there's a right to be informed how our information is used. There's a right to access, right of access. There's right of rectification. Then there's also right to erasure and restrict processing of information. You know, the startup that I'm consulting these days as an IT project lead, one of my tasks was to actually sit down with the partners, legal and financial consultants, as well as the computer programmers to develop 2 important modules in our platform. One, to let customers know how much information we are saving on them and provide them a chance to download all data that we save on them. It was quite a difficult task, to tell you the truth, but when you think of legal and financial angles.
Of course.
And similarly, the other module that I had to work on was the right to forget option. That is the right to delete, give users the right to delete their account. And you know why we did this? We did this because the company I consult for is based in Germany, and EU requires every company to be a GDPR compliant.
Of course.
And GDPR, by the way, allows the EU's data protection authorities to issue fines up to about 20 million euros, or your 4% of annual global turnover, whichever is the higher one. So to come to your question now, it's when you look at the when I look at the number of cases that have come up in the courts or the fines that have been imposed, you will see that the GDPR has been quite stringent, I must say. Mm-hmm. Just to give you an example, Google was fined 50 million euros for not being able to provide information to its users in consent policies that it should have granted people more control over how Google is processing the personal data. And similarly, you remember the case of Hamburg, when the Hamburg's Commissioner for Data Protection and Freedom of Information imposed a 35 million euro fine for data protection violation to H&M, you know, this online the clothing retail.
Yeah, the clothing retail.
The violation in question was that the senior management happened to know that they gained information on several of its employees. And likewise, there's you know another retailer called the laptop retailer in Germany called as Notebook Billiger. Mm-hmm. So the state commissioner for data protection in Lower Saxony imposed a 10 million euro fine on them. And the violation was supposed to be that the company was using video surveillance to monitor its employees for at least 2 years with no legal justification given.
Wow.
This all information that I've just shared is all available on EU's website, you know. But just last month, I heard that in January 2021, that Notebook Billiger management is going to challenge this decision for the fine that has been imposed on them. But you see, Jesus, regardless of these challenges and court battles, you see the seriousness at the level of EU's GDPR approach. I strongly feel that the awareness about GDPR is only going to increase with time.
I think we all hope for that. And there's a big plus in GDPR on putting the customer, the user, first. I think it helps raise awareness in among the population about the importance of privacy, and it makes the population monitors of their privacy and their security all around the media. So a final question, because this has been enlightening, but I don't want to take more time from you.
Sure.
So how can future policies address the gaps that GDPR doesn't cover? And what are the barriers to implementing these kind of policies in other countries?
Well, that's a bit tough to answer, you know. With technologies and data sets rapidly growing, the concerns of privacy and data protections are going to surround us, or continuously going to surround us, in fact, more actively than before. The advancements that you see that are taking place in the area of data analytics or in artificial intelligence, our reliance on internet-based technologies is only going to increase. But I think the same will also going to apply on GDPR. I personally find GDPR as an evolving regulation. You know, sometimes I hear that about GDPR and I get a feeling as if GDPR was developed from scratch when it was introduced in 2016. The GDPR, you know, is not an entirely new set of data protection rules for the EU. In fact, it's an evolution of the existing set of rules that existed since 1995.
Of course.
And they were based on the strong data protection principles set out in a directive that was called as Data Protection
Process.
Directive. So this DPD, the Data Protection Directive, had more than 30 articles, you know, when it was introduced in 1995.
It's an evolution.
So when you talk of future policies, you have to consider that GDPR is going to only evolve itself with the changing digital landscape. And frankly, it did not evolve if it did not evolve, you know, like the way it should, you're going to have a very serious situation.
Of course.
But I personally feel that if GDPR did not evolve, it is going to be replaced by another or even, stricter regulation. Which should be fine, you know, like just like GDPR replaced DPD.
Mm-hmm.
you understand that GDPR rules are applicable within Europe. But I feel EU is in a very unique position to promote GDPR even outside its territories. The digital platforms that we engage with, you know, they offer us engagement of different sorts. But for the digital platforms, it's a commercial activity. So for any commercial activity, you have to follow certain trade or commercial regulations, which are outlined by bilateral or multilateral agreements, I don't know, by World Trade Organization or other entities. I feel EU is in a very unique position to promote GDPR with countries that are outside EU. The other countries would be sort of bound to follow GDPR in one way or another with whom EU conducts its business. So it would be kind of a, you know, incentive, so to say.
Of course.
And just to give you one factual information, that if you look at the last GDPR evaluation report that came out of EU, they have actually expressed to promote convergence and developing international cooperation as far as GDPR is concerned. In fact, you will be surprised to know that EU also wished to set up a data protection academy to facilitate and support exchanges between European and international regulators.
Oh, really?
But what is here more interesting, Jesus, you know, that European Commission wishes to support ongoing reform processes with third countries to introduce new or modernized data protection rules by sharing its own experiences that it has learned and sharing some best practices. And one example is their engagement with African partners, and so they would like to confirm that, they would like to take that at the GDPR at that level. And then you also know that EU also wishes to engage with international and regional organizations such as OECD or ASEAN or G20, where they wish to promote these data flows based on high data protection standards. Mm-hmm. So this is how I see GDPR getting promoted outside EU boundaries.
So the EU has this unique opportunity of becoming a spearhead of privacy and data regulation policies around the world. That is simply amazing. Well, everything you have said in this interview is amazing and a lot to take in. I want to thank you in the name of the Bulletin and everyone for your information, for your insights, and for your recommendations. I think I'm going to look better at my privacy regulations.
You're most welcome. It was a pleasure to interact with you guys, and I hope that some information that I provided was helpful and useful. I thank you very much.
Okay, that was a lot to take in, Caroline. Do you think you are part of that plus 60% that doesn't secure their privacy online?
You know, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I worked at a cybersecurity company for a year and a half, and I think I might still be part of that 60%. I definitely have improved my password game, but I definitely don't do all the things that Dr. Vaccari mentioned.
Well, all of us need to listen from now on to his advices.
Definitely.
So, okay, now that we finish off with some, we want to finish off with some announcements and updates on the Willy Brandt School students.
First, the mental health phone line of UniAFWAT is looking for both English and German-speaking volunteers. All volunteers will receive training to prepare them to manage the hotline. You can find more info on the UniAFWAT website.
Second, remember to prepare your commitment awards ideas for submission. Applications open on March 1st and closes on April 11th.
Third, this is a reminder, or perhaps you're learning about it for the first time, that the student government created an internship Moodle platform, which is a resource to help you find and land a summer internship. They post internship listings and give you tips on things like sending cold emails. By the way, Jesus, I think this is a good moment to give a shout out to our student government representatives this semester, Hussein, Daphne, and Mikaela. I think I speak for everyone when I say they have done an amazing job at creating a support system for students, have been extremely responsive to student needs. We appreciate you.
Totally. Finally, a big reminder to pay registration fees before March 15th. Also, if you want to contribute for the Bullet Train blog or podcast, please don't hesitate to reach out. We welcome new ideas and contributions. That's it for us. Thanks for tuning in and have a great week, everyone.